Today at Reader's Corner, Daniel Tudor, co-author of North Korea Confidential. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. For decades, North Korea has operated as a prime example of a hermit kingdom, a nation ruled by a despotic family regime where propaganda and historical, political, and economic theater are a daily ritual for the country's 25 million citizens. In his book, North Korea Confidential, co-written by journalist James Pearson, Daniel Tudor gives us the rest of the story of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Looking at the failure of the state following the devastating famine of the 1990s, Dan Tudor describes the ways that grassroots capitalism has affected the people, culture, and the future of the DPRK. Daniel Tudor is the former Korea correspondent for The Economist and author of Korea, The Impossible Country. A columnist for a Korean newspaper, Daniel Tudor is a regular commentator on Korea-related topics for the BBC, Al Jazeera, and others. He joins us today by Skype, all the way from Seoul, South Korea. Daniel Tudor, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you very much. Great to be with you.
Your book was just a real eye-opener, a look inside the country of North Korea that not many of us get. And I might start off with the first question. In your intro, I found it very, very amusing, you might say. You actually talked about the fact that, this isn't the last word on North Korea. And you say, and so we politely ask the reader not to have such expectations. And the word that caught me more than anything else was politely. I thought, gee, when's the last time I've heard an author living in the West say anything about being polite? That was quite generous of you. Is that the culture you're living in over there or what?
Maybe we're just too British. I don't know. But for both of us, we've always had this sense that when you write about North Korea, you're operating with blinkers on or you're operating with a very limited amount of information, because you can't just go there. You can't just walk down the street and ask, Mr. Kim what he thinks about, the country's government or pretty much anything, really. I mean, you can't just survey people. You can't find out what people think.
Sure.
You can't get statistics because the government doesn't even have statistics. And if they did, they might not share them with you. Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to reporting on North Korea, it's not like reporting on, say, the U.S. or my country or South Korea even, where information is just very, very much available and most things are knowable. North Korea is just not like that. So there's always this limitation that I think we have to acknowledge. And I think a lot of, there are commentators on North Korea, I think, so the academic sphere or, certain people who certain authors who I think we admire a lot, will admit that too. But then you get a certain class of media commentator who, North Korea is X, Y, Z. This is North Korea. And you can't really say that with North Korea. Because there is this limitation in terms of information. And so I think we have to be a little bit more humble. And when we say, okay, North Korea, such and such a thing is going on, we always have to have this caveat. Well, such and such a person said this is going on. And we asked another person, is that going on? They said yes. And then we read somewhere else that that thing is going on. Now, in reporting about, say, my country, that may not be enough for you to say, yes, this is definitely true. But with North Korea, you just go, well, I'm not going to get any more information than this. So I'm going to assume it's true, but I'll put this asterisk by it and say, well, let's say 95% confidence that it's true. So we have to be a little bit humble, I think, with reporting on North Korea.
That makes sense. Help us understand the North Korea of today. Most of us, of course, would call North Korea a communist country, a socialist country, and yet it has its feudal roots that really make it a little bit more difficult to write off as just another communist country. Could you help us with that one?
Yeah, I wouldn't even call it communist anymore. You've got three generations of hereditary rule. That's not very communist. And in terms of how people are living, since the mid-1990s, as you mentioned in the intro, there's this huge famine. Possibly over a million people died, and definitely hundreds of thousands of people died. And the core of that is the breakdown of this state distribution system, where in the past people had been receiving food from the state. And that's a communist structure, right? I mean, yeah, the state provides basic food and education and housing, this kind of basics for life, provides those things to you. And in return, you offer your unwavering loyalty to the state. And they also, part of the narrative is that they protect you from Japan. So is this kind of this, evil foreign barbarian colonialists. So that's the original sort of bargain with North Korea and the state and the people. But yeah, the heart of it is this distribution system, which is, it's a communist thing. And that's gone from the mid-1990s onwards. And the lives that people are living, I mean, they're going to street markets, they're buying and selling products to make a living. And, from top to bottom now, North Korea is, I mean, you wouldn't say that the system is capitalist. People live through capitalism, and the system itself is becoming capitalistic, if not legally capitalist. So I don't think we can really call it communist anymore.
Right.
I've always seen it as more of a kind of a continuation of the old Joseon dynasty that existed before Korea was colonized by Japan. Yeah, it's essentially a monarchical system where you have one family sort of ruling house, and then you have around them a series of less powerful but still very powerful families and courtiers, people like that. And we still see that today in North Korea. So I think for me, communism is a very late entry into the North Korean psyche. And they've more or less become a feudalistic dictatorship. The reality of North Korea is not very communistic at all, no.
So in addition to the official Kim family governance, if we can put it gently, there's the Organization and Guidance Department, OGD, which seems to be a shadow power structure. Help us understand how that functions alongside or in addition to the Kim family.
Okay. So this Organization and Guidance Department, I mean, actually, when we wrote the book, we felt that this group had more power than we feel it has now, I would say. I guess it's a dynamic thing. Power changes over time.
Sure.
And as Kim Jong-un's leadership has continued, I think it's probably fair to say he's accumulated more power as he's gone along. But anyway, this Organization and Guidance Division, they were the eyes and ears of Kim Jong-il, his father. So when Kim Jong-il was trying to build up and transfer power from his father to himself during the later years of Kim Il-sung's rule, so the founder of the state, when the second Kim was trying to accumulate power for himself, he took control of this group called Organization and Guidance Division. Now, they originally weren't such an important organization, but anyway, he made it so that, and I think partly with his father's blessing, over time, he made it so that if person X wants to talk to person Y and they're not in the same area of the government, then they have to go through this Organization and Guidance Department. And also, they became the ones who had a file on everybody. If anybody was going to be hired for a particular job, it went through them. And they'd have spies in every organization and a spy to spy on that spy. Like this kind of double spying system there. And so over time, this organization becomes very, very powerful. And the deputy directors, because the director of that organization was Kim Jong-il himself, the deputy directors of that organization, they all became, individually very powerful and, overseeing certain areas of the government, such as, state security or what you call it, the Stasi type of organization. But anyway, the different branches of the government had somebody responsible for them within this OGD structure. Now, also what we see is that OGD is partly those people and also partly the Kim family sort of secretariat, like the people who organize Kim Jong-un's diary or Kim Jong-il before, people who are responsible for the family's personal security and also money, I think. So it's a kind of double organization that's partly Kim family organization and partly a somewhat separate entity. And so it becomes kind of murky. I mean, to what extent is it Kim family and to what extent is it not? But anyway, what we know is that when Kim Jong-il died, obviously huge changes within the regime in terms of personnel. So certain people, so if you saw the people walking alongside his car at the funeral, yeah, most of those guys got kicked out, you know, either, you know, executed or retired, or something happened to them fairly soon after the transfer of power to Kim Jong-un. But the people who are the deputy directors of this OGD, they all stayed in place. So that gives you this idea that actually this organization itself, or these guys, are very powerful. I think over time we've seen that, actually since we've written the book, I would say that this idea that the OGD is super, super powerful has taken somewhat of a knock, as Kim Jong-un has, you know, within this dynamic, you know, ever-changing atmosphere of power, or within this ever-changing environment of power, Kim Jong-un has become more like this overarching powerful figure rather than the simple leader of a coalition. But again, a lot of this is, when we began this interview, you know, this caveat of we don't necessarily know for 100% certainty that this is what's definitely going on. But based on what people say to us and what we can infer from knowledge of the past and also reading of current sources, that's what we have come to believe.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Daniel Tudor, co-author of North Korea Confidential. I don't think there's many Westerners who regard North Korea as a market economy. And yet, one of the really interesting things about your book is your discussion of unofficial markets operating in the DPRK, the marketization working for North Korea. Help us understand how that works in what is a dictatorship.
Right. Okay. So I'd say there's two strands of capitalism or capitalistic activity going on. One is this sort of grassroots capitalism where you see street markets. Now, I think usually what happens is the goods that are sold in these places are imported from China. So you'll get somebody who is relatively privileged, not necessarily really high up in the regime, but might know a few people and can pay bribes to leave the country and come back, you know, and bring goods in. Or maybe it will be an ethnic Chinese North Korean, because there are people who are from way back, you know, Chinese people living in North Korea, and they have more freedom to come and go, and they've always had that. Now, from the 1980s, 90s, those guys, suddenly with the rise of China, the great wealth in China that's appeared, those guys have been able to exploit this ability to go back and forth to actually conduct a lot of trade and make money. Anyway, so somebody who can will go to China, bring back some kind of consumer goods or anything that people might want to buy on a street market. And of course, you get local produce as well. So farms, and maybe they report they've produced 10 when they produce 15 and they sell 5 in the market, something like that. So anyway, you're getting these markets appearing, and you'll get a wholesaler. Somebody will bring a lot of stuff in, perhaps from China, sell it. You know, it will start appearing, you know, on a smaller scale in you know, street markets all over the country. And people go and, you know, buy what they want to buy. Of course, people are buyers and sellers as well. Somebody will have a market stall, but then they'll be using the money that they've earned to buy from the next stall something they're not selling themselves. And whole families depend on this now. Usually it's the mother. You have some middle-aged lady who will be the stall holder. It's traditionally a man in North Korea, you know, works for a state organization. And over time, their salaries have basically become worthless. So, you know, less than a dollar a month or something pathetic like that. And so those guys have kind of been stuck in their state-owned organization jobs while their wife has been free to actually get involved in business. That's kind of changing the family dynamic as well. Women have a bit more power than they used to. Although increasingly now men are able to bribe their way out of their state-owned organization job. You know, you pay a certain amount to your boss each month, and then he says, okay, well, we'll say you're ill or something, and then he can go and join his wife. So maybe he'll go off on his bicycle, or if he's got some money, motorbike, go off, perhaps buy something from a wholesaler, come back, and his wife sells it in the stall. So that's going on, and that's been going on since the 1990s, since the famine. And the word for this is Changmadang, a market, a street market. And I think it's kind of legally gray now, but originally it was illegal, properly illegal. But then, you know, if you're the stallholder, you just pay a bribe to the cop or the security person who's walking around, and he goes, okay, fine. And that effectively functions as a tax. So it's a very fixed, it's usually a very fixed sum. Like, you know how much it is, they know how much it is, and you just pay it and it's done. And so it's kind of like tax. Then the other system, parallel economy of sorts that's going on, that we call public-private enterprise, you get state-owned organizations, you know, perhaps like a big government ministry, you know, defense or big organizations, you know, the military, whoever, and you know, they have the ability to operate state-owned companies. And so you might get a department store, you know, some big retail operation that is owned by a government department. Now, technically, because it's state-owned, all the money that company generates, you know, goes to the state. But in reality, that's usually not the case. The person who collects it from you maybe takes some for himself, then some more of it goes up, then some more of it goes up. And then, yeah, eventually some will find its way into the Kim family's coffers, I would imagine. And also it pays people's salaries in the government department because the government's basically broke. They need to get money from somewhere and, you know, pay their people. Now, obviously, if you're the entrepreneur, that's a little bit scary because, you know, at some point, someone may turn around, some powerful person may turn around and say, oh, you're not having this anymore. We're taking it off you. And yeah, I just continue on with my business as I would in any other country. The only difference being I've always got that fear of, you know, somebody taking it from me.
So let's talk about North Korean leisure time. How do they spend their time? You've referred to them at one point as the Irish of the East. I don't know whether that requires an apology to the Irish or not. So why don't you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah. I mean, that's actually, I think that's an old expression. It's definitely not one we've come up with. But stereotypes all the way, I'm afraid. Right. Yeah, it's there's a phrase in Korean, umjugamu. It's like music, dancing, and drinking, and that's pretty much how people spend their downtime in North Korea. I mean, there aren't that many leisure opportunities, I would say. I mean, there's no, you know, Netflix, and you can't just get on the train or fly somewhere and, you know, go on holiday. But there is a lot of alcohol, and there always has been. And people actually make their own alcohol in North Korea. Every small town or village, you'll have one or two old ladies who are known for being really good at making moonshine. And I mean, something you'll see if you go to North Korea. If you're out in the countryside or in a park somewhere and the weather isn't too cold, you know, you'll see big groups of people just singing songs and drinking this stuff called soju, which, I mean, if you've been to South Korea, you'll see soju as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, dancing and singing and drinking and eating. And I mean, it's fun. Yeah. And it's something anyone can do, really. And life in North Korea is not easy, of course. It's, you know, very, very tough for most people. There's a lot of poverty. You have this, I guess, stress of, although, you know, people have internalized it over the years, but this stress of dealing with a system that is so, you know, controlling, I would imagine. And so something like drinking, getting drunk, from my perspective too, I mean, you know, it's a great escape sometimes, you know? And drinking is the main one, I would say.
Do I remember reading in your book that you actually need some kind of a permit in order to travel if you're a North Korean citizen? I'm not talking about you guys coming up from the South. You just don't go anywhere you want to go in North Korea, even though you are a citizen.
Right. Now, technically that's true, but also if you pay a bribe, it's generally okay. it shouldn't be like that, of course. But yeah, so let's say you want to go into Pyongyang and you're not from Pyongyang. Now, Pyongyang is the fortress, you know, it's the capital, it's the center of everything where everyone wants to go. If you're from some other part of North Korea, you want to go into Pyongyang, well, what you might notice on the road signs on the way in, the word Pyongyang appears, and then it will have sort of three red lines through it. And that means unless you've got a permit to be here, you don't come in here. And so if you get caught, you're not a Pyongyang citizen. Yeah, you're breaking the law. And so you can be punished. And obviously punishment in North Korea is quite severe indeed. Now, if you pay something like $30, you can be in Pyongyang. If you give that money to the people who catch you, or you bribe somebody to give you that permit, then you'll be able to stay in Pyongyang. Now, to go into another city, it won't cost anything like as much. because there's less kind of economic value in being in those cities. But also, actually, I would say, because I mentioned the train before, I mean, you can take a train to another city, but it might take a very long time. A train across the country will probably break down, or will probably have no power at some point. So it could take several days to get a train across the country, whereas, say, in South Korea, which is, I guess in terms of square mileage, is not quite as big as North Korea, but anyway, roughly comparable. You can get across South Korea in like 2.5 hours on one of the fast trains, but in North Korea, it might take 3 or 4 days. And so, yeah, there is this legal and also technical
Right.
limitation.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Daniel Tudor, co-author of North Korea Confidential. In the book, Tudor pulls back the curtain on daily life in the Hermit Kingdom. So let's talk about crime and punishment in North Korea. Political imprisonment, especially as it applies to those who, not your ordinary lawbreakers, but those who are committing what North Koreans would call political crimes. I think it's the SSD that's in charge. How do they catch people?
A huge network of informers. So every local area, so like, say your neighborhood apartment complex, a lot of people live in apartments. You'll have this group called Inminban, which is like a sort of a citizens group, and they'll be a leader of that group. And they're tasked with often very boring things like organizing, the sweeping up of fallen leaves in the autumn, that kind of stuff, keeping the roads looking nice around the area. But then there'll also be this imperative of if you hear anybody saying anything bad about the government, then you have to report that. And if you don't report that, and you're known to not report that, then also you become a bad person, right? And then with any group like this, you'll also have a kind of secret informant, somebody who perhaps has previously been caught doing some sort of crime, or perhaps who has been accused of some political crime before. And they'll be kind of bullied into becoming this informant. So if the head of this group doesn't report something or is themselves doing something, then that person will report them. And so you got this everywhere you go, this sort of double system of informant. And so, yeah, it's pretty hard to, I guess, get anything past them. But in this day and age, of course, as we've said, people no longer rely on or can no longer rely on the state to provide everything for them. They have to fend for themselves. So that's bred a certain amount of disrespect for authority, which is good, I would say. And so probably a lot less gets reported than before, or a lot more, if something does get uncovered, a lot more can be overlooked with a bribe as well. So it's less easy than before for the state to control people. But what we're seeing now, and I think this was, we were too early with our book to really catch this, is use of technology. And I think as we're seeing in China and all over the world, really, again, technology, mobile communication, internet has not come to China yet. So it's in North Korea yet. But anyway, I think dawn of the information age, we've seen this idea that it's going to be a great force for democratization, but actually it turns out that that's not really the case. And a state that wants to use it for its own purposes can do. And so when you've got smartphones, and North Koreans now increasingly have smartphones, they can't use them, they can't actually go on the internet, but they can take pictures and play games and stuff like that. And what was happening was people were sharing South Korean pop music files, or files of South Korean TV shows. They're very, very popular in North Korea. Obviously, same language, but just infinitely more fun and interesting to watch, and give a sense of what's going on in the outside world. And so people are sharing these files. If you've got a computer, or if you've got a mobile phone, or if you've got any kind of device where you can share files, any way of transferring files between devices. This has been going on for a while, and now the government is trying to clamp down on that, of course. And so what they've done is, if you've got a phone or a tablet device, and the operating system is, say for a mobile phone in North Korea, it's based on Android, but it's been modified a little bit. So what will happen is, let's say that you like a certain piece of K-pop, South Korean music. You give me that file, you send it to me, and it's on my phone. And then I send it to somebody else, and then it's on their computer, and they put it on a USB drive, and then it goes to somebody else.
what will happen is your device will stamp that file digitally. Then I get the file, and then my phone stamps it too, because the operating system of both our phones is telling our phones to do that. And so everywhere along the chain, the file is being stamped all the way along the chain. So if one person at the end gets busted, then we all get busted. And so that obviously is a great disincentive now to sharing these kind of files. Yeah, so, I think we're seeing that, to sum up, I would say traditionally a system of informants, and over time that's become eroded because of this new capitalism, disrespect for authority, which is good. And then the state strikes back with technology.
So I have a two-part question that I think will pretty much wind up our interview here today. The talks between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, I just wonder, first of all, what do South Koreans think of those talks? I've read what the South Korean government thinks of them, I guess, but I'll let you comment on that as well. And then secondly, just your own thoughts on whether you think there's any future to reunification, and what kind of game is Kim Jong-un playing here if he wants to get into these talks?
Right. Okay. So I think, again, this is not my area of expertise, but what I would say is that South Koreans generally are positive. I think at the beginning, they were highly positive. Maybe 80% approval of President Moon, 80% roughly approval of this peace and talks process. Over time, there's a certain amount of cynicism that's set in. And I think a lot of that is that, probably a lot of people believe that denuclearization is not going to happen, or at least the North Korean definition of it is quite different to the American definition of it. And of course, with North Korea, we've had talks and deals before that in the end haven't really come to very much. And so, it's natural for cynicism to set in. But what I would say is it's a lot better than what we were seeing just over a year ago. Fire and fury, and I think that was genuinely dangerous at the time. I was really quite worried, and I think a lot of people who follow North Korea and have some knowledge about the topic were also getting very worried. And for the first time, usually there's a hysteria in the newspapers, but people who know something usually would let's not panic. But this time it was quite different, it seemed. For me, I think, If you're South and North Korea, you want to get along and have all this economic exchange. If you're North Korea, you want to keep your nukes, basically, or you want an extremely ironclad guarantee that America isn't going to destroy you. And so to get to a certain level of trust, I think it's very, very difficult. Anyway, I think from the perspective of South Korea, this government here, its priority is really rapprochement with North Korea, removing the threat of war through economic exchange and closer cooperation. So I suppose sometimes people will talk about this gap between the interests of the US and South Korea. And to some extent that's true. But there is this longstanding alliance that is still being respected, despite what some people would say. I actually advised the South Korean government on media issues. So I think I know a little bit about what the South Korean government is trying to do, and I do support it. And I think that despite obvious natural skepticism, what's going on now is better than anything else that could be happening. People who criticize this process should offer an alternative before doing so.
Well, our time is limited today, but it's not limited for our readers, who can grab a copy of this book, North Korea Confidential: Private Markets, Fashion Trends, Prison Camps, Dissenters and Defectors, by Daniel Tudor and James Pearson. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks very much.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you missed some of our recent shows, you can find them on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. You can also sign up for our free podcast email on the website and download our free app for mobile devices to listen anytime, anywhere.